I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is Ken Myers, a partner at Fenwick and West. Ken, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, David. Nice to see you again, as always.
So we're going to talk about several things on today's podcast. First of all, your background, how you came to practice M&A at Fenwick. Second, your relationship with Alexander Corey, one of your mentors early in your career. Third, the challenges of working in a two-lawyer couple. Your wife, Ting Chen, is a partner at Cravath. Your work on deal board, a side project you have at Fenwick. And then finally, what you do when you're not practicing law. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to the practice.
Sure. Those are good topics. Happy to be talking about all this. So yeah, how did I come to be practicing M&A at Fenwick? I mean, it certainly was not a preordained plan or anything that I had mapped out early on. So I grew up in Michigan. My mother's Japanese, my dad's white, and they had a little translating, interpreting, consulting business focused on the auto industry. And I thought I was going to be in business, maybe running my parents' company one day. So I went to the B school, got a BBA at the University of Michigan, which was very close to where I grew up. And so that's what I was oriented towards. Started college in the fall of 97. And that's when we were all just getting our first email addresses and instant messenger, and the internet was just becoming a thing, you know, and I was very prescient. I was like, this internet thing, it's going to be big. So I really wanted to go into business and into e-commerce, and all this juniors and seniors in front of me were all getting really cool jobs at different startups and moving out west. And so that had kind of captured my imagination. And so I was like, that's what I want to do out of college. Of course, I graduated in 2001. And so everything was melting down. By the time I graduated, the company I was going to go work for went out of business during my senior year. And I remember the OCS, Office of Career Services, said, you know, just wait until the fall, we'll get you a new slate. And I had good grades and everything, so I wasn't worried. September 2001 was also not a particularly good time to be looking for a job in business with a business degree in New York with 9/11. So it was kind of back to the drawing board. And really, I was just trying to think of, like, what could I do next? I had conversations with my parents, like, what should I do? You know, it was just all on the table. Master of Accounting, GRE, Peace Corps, MBA, JD, just anything. And I would have been most naturally inclined to get an MBA, I think. But coming straight out of college, you know, you don't have the MBA programs. I mean, probably rightfully so. They don't take a lot of kids right straight through. So it didn't matter if you had a great GMAT score. The likelihood of being in a top program was an uphill battle. So I thought of going to law school. My dad, who did get a JD, didn't practice as a lawyer, but always said, you can do anything with a law degree. Now, I might quibble now with that. But still, that was what was in my mind, and decided to give law school a shot. Actually, it's a funny story. I remember sitting down at my computer, and there was this countdown. I remember looking at this clock. It was about 15 minutes until the early bird discount for the LSAT was like going to expire at midnight of whatever day it was. And, you know, I'm broke. I didn't have a job. I'm living at home. If I didn't click yes, if I didn't click that button in those 15 minutes, I wouldn't have taken the LSAT. I would have gone down one of the other paths. So I clicked it and decided to take the LSAT and went to Borders. Being from Michigan, and it was very sad when Borders is no longer with us, but went to the bookstore, got my Princeton Review book for LSAT study guide, didn't write in it so I could return it the following week once I got through and got the Kaplan book and whatever others. And so that's how I studied for the LSAT. That was 1 month into the future. And that's what I did. And I took the LSAT, and you get the score back and you do well enough on that and you apply to different places and you get into good schools and the boxes come back, the acceptance come back, and everyone gets excited and you're like, all right, let's see how this goes. And frankly, my goal at the time was just like, get a job. Whatever's going to do to facilitate getting a job. Because at the time, I was living at home in Michigan and I was a rowing coach to fill my time. And so then I went to law school. I had no idea really what it meant to be a lawyer other than what you see on TV. And I was kind of resigned to that because that just seemed so far from what I was oriented towards, you know, business school and the running of companies and deals and things like that. So it really wasn't until my 1L summer, I summered in New York at Kay Scholer, And that's the first time I encountered deal work, kind of corporate transactional work. And I was a summer associate on an M&A deal. And there's a third year associate on the deal who was running it. And to my eyes, like, seemed so competent. And I mean, he was competent as running the deal and participating in negotiations and drafting. And it just really opened my eyes. I was like, oh, this is now a thing that taps into my interests. And it's not just a matter of having a job that pays the bills. It was something that I could really be interested in and invested in. So that illuminated a potential trajectory. And so then going back to school for my 2L year, that really focused my search for the true 2L summer associate job onto those firms that are focused on corporate work and M&A.
So you were an M&A lawyer from the time you started at Sullivan & Cromwell as an associate.
Yeah. So when you start at S&C, you're not assigned to a particular practice group other than corporate generally. And then within corporate, there are different things you can rotate around. I mean, it's called the general practice. And when I first started, because of my interest in tech, I gravitated towards the IP group, right? Which is where if there was tech work, you know, sort of tech and IP are not synonymous, certainly, but there's some overlap. And so I started out my first year being a junior IP associate who is focused on IP issues on M&A parts of the deal. And then what happened was some of the senior associates in the M&A group approached me and said, hey, would you be interested in joining the M&A group and running the whole deal and training for that role? And that piqued my interest. And while I was interested in tech and IP, you know, as a subject matter, I could really see myself in the M&A associate role, project managing, frankly, and that being something I thought that I would be good at, that I was interested in becoming better at. I just like the centrality of the role of the M&A team, because obviously an M&A deal takes multiple dozens of people on each side to make it happen with different areas and different focuses. And being the M&A person that's at the center of it all and orchestrating it, and you're the closest to the client at a high level, I just that really appealed to me. And so I joined the M&A group, and it's like 18 months in, you know, so during my second year.
And then talk a little bit about your relationship with Alexandra Corey. You gave a eulogy at her memorial service about a year and a half ago, and she had a formative influence on your career. This is an M&A partner at Sullivan.
Yeah, Alexandra. Yeah, we've, you know, it's funny, like right after we hang up with our session, I'm jumping into some interviews of some candidates for the Alexandra Corey Memorial Scholarship at HEAF, which is an organization that she spent a lot of time with. So yeah, her influence on me is continued and is just part of my life and will be for a long time. So yeah, Alexandra, she was, you know, no one I don't think just starts out as being a mentor. I think true mentors don't really get assigned to you. You have to kind of earn it. And you had to earn it from Alexandra for sure. But, you know, we started just working on some deals, and she was unique in that, you know, she was willing to work with pretty junior associates and test them out. And certainly there were some folks where didn't really cut it, didn't really mesh with her. You know, she moved on from them pretty quickly. But if you clicked with her, she would really invest in you, and you'd do a series of deals together. And it was kind of an all-consuming experience. And if anyone out there is listening who's worked with her, probably chuckling in the same way, because they know exactly what I'm talking about. It's a very intense experience where you get into the deal and there's no senior associate. You are the senior associate even as a junior, right? And that just comes with a lot of responsibility. And you just have to get up to speed really quickly. And the way that she processed a deal, like with their documents, they go back and forth, you negotiate them. Her approach was always, you are an equal partner in that effort. I mean, she challenged you, you know? She would be most upset with you if all you did was take her orders and direction. What she wanted to hear from you, what is your idea? What do you think we should do? And then speak up. Why didn't you say that? Why didn't you say that at the meeting when it was in front of the client or the other side? And so she challenged you, but at the same time, breathe her faith into you. And really, that's what it was, the instilling of self-confidence as a result of going through that experience. Working in big law as a junior associate in M&A, I mean, it can be challenging, right? The demands that are placed on you. And sometimes it can get pretty dark after long hours and you aren't sure whether you're doing the right thing. You don't know if it's worthwhile. And to have someone who, while still putting you through paces, can say, you're smart, you have good ideas, and you got this. That kind of light is, I think, really important for any M&A associate who's trying to do this at the highest level.
And how did that change how you train younger associates and how you thought about your career? Because obviously, as a mid-level associate, you moved to Fenwick on the West Coast.
Yeah, I aspire to work with my associates in the way that she worked with me, which is really taking the time to go through substantively with the team, not just asynchronously working, you know, hear my comments, or go process them or something like that, and just do what I say. It's working through things together. And it's funny because in the time of the pandemic, I mean, everyone is now, you know, we're doing Zoom or Teams or whatever with screen shares and live drafting together. That's actually a thing that's, it might be kind of a new thing for our practice, right? But none of that was the case in 2008 or so. So she was like ahead of her time on this, where we'd be on the phone together working through something, and we each have the document open on the system, and she would have it open, I'd have it open, I'd be editing it, and then she'd be constantly closing and opening the document, which is the way of sort of refreshing it. So it was sort of quasi live. I mean, if she were still practicing now, I mean, I know that she'd be all over the technology and the way that we practice. She would have been all about it. But yeah, it's definitely has influenced the way that I interact with the team. And I aspire to do it. I mean, it's hard. I mean, I realize now like how much effort it takes when you're on the receiving end of intensive mentoring, right? It's sort of about survival. And so now that I'm kind of on the other side of that, I'm appreciating fully the amount of effort that it took on her part to put in that time with me. And I'm like increasingly and ever grateful for that. Because yeah, sometimes it is just easier to say, like, do what I say, just reflect my comments, fix, you know? And to actually walk through that together and say like, hey, here's the issue. I was saying, how should we fix this? And let's have a conversation about that. And what the junior attorney gets out of that conversation is, I think, much richer than if it's just dictated to them. So that's influenced me quite a bit. And telling her that I was moving to Fenwick was, I mean, this is one of the hardest conversations I've ever had. But she had like a tear in her eye as she said, you know, I get it. And I'll just carry that with me.
So part of the attraction for you clearly was this affinity for technology that stemmed even from the time you were a teenager.
Yeah. I mean, it probably goes back to no deeper than, you know, I'm an adolescent teenage boy loving video games, and that leads to building computers, and this is what your personal interest is. And with the dot-com crash, I was like, okay, well, we can just put these dreams aside and you just got to get a job. Like, that's just what you have to do. And that leads you down this path of do the thing that is the safest and the most prestigious or whatever. And that leads you on the path. And lawyers are notoriously risk averse, and maybe with good reason. But I think there's a logic to like how I ended up and where I was. And I have absolutely no regrets about S&C or my time there, or how formative, of course. But I think as I got to fifth year or so, and I really thought that I would spend the rest of my career at S&C, but I wanted it to be, if given the opportunity, of course, don't take any of that for granted, but I wanted to make that an affirmative choice. And the only way to make that an affirmative choice is to consider something else and then choose not to do that and stay where you are. So I asked myself, like, what would the alternative be? What is the other thing that you would think about doing, if anything? And for me, the clear answer was, well, I love doing M&A. I love the process of M&A. I love the skill set that it requires, the personalities, just it all lined up for me. I was like, if I could focus the underlying subject matter on tech, like that would be the best of all worlds. Is that possible? And so I interviewed with a bunch of firms on the West Coast asking that question, like, what does tech M&A look like? Is it sufficiently rigorous? Is it sufficiently prestigious? Is it sufficiently important? Sufficiently interesting? You know, all these things I had as open questions. And I met with all the firms. And at the time, in late 2011, New York didn't really feel like the place to be having those conversations. And so I was like, if I want to do this, I want to give it a try on the West Coast. And so I interviewed with a number of the firms and then clicked the best with Fenwick. They had just come off the Facebook IPO, had just done Instagram, and just seemed like they were right place at the right time kind of thing for what Silicon Valley was going to be doing. And you look at the past decade in terms of what tech has done, its importance in our economy, the world. You know, when I started the process of looking around, I was not thinking that I was going to move. And then I did. There was an intervening event. My father passed away in between the time of my interviews and when I accepted. And I think that played a part. I don't know exactly. It's hard to connect the dots directly, but I think that had a big impact.
And you decided to make this move. I mean, you and Tang were together at that point. I'm assuming it had been together since law school. So you're making this move. Yeah, this is challenging, not only professionally, but personally.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie. 2012 was a pretty dark and difficult time. I mean, my dad had just passed and work was, you know, it's demanding. And moving to the West Coast, there was an aspect of I needed a fresh start and some clearance. And the idea was Ting was going to join at some point, but Cravath told her that's not the wisest move. You're going to make partner here. I had accepted and I was going to go out there and we're like, well, we'll figure it out. And so I moved out and, you know, we didn't quite know the end game at that time. It was daunting to make that move. But in retrospect, I think us being not in the same place was actually conducive to our respective careers. And so being able to spend a weekend or a week together a month, like we could really focus on doing things, plan around that. And it actually was, I think, a positive influence, not just on our careers, but actually on our relationship. We didn't know that that was going to be the case. It was a happy result. But yeah, we were a long distance marriage for 3.5-4 years.
And Fenwick opened an office in New York maybe 4 or 5 years ago, which obviously allowed you to come back.
Yeah. So there was about a 3-week stretch in which I had my 36th birthday on the partner meeting. My birthday is in October. So it happened to be that day. So that day is my 36th birthday. I was elected there. And the way Fenwick does it, it's usually not a surprise. So they tell you in advance, like, hey, plan to be at the meeting. So the first action of the meeting is to elect in the new partners and then they invite them in. And so I was invited in and someone had known it was my birthday. And so I had my first memory of this was inviting me in and the whole partnership singing me happy birthday, which is like, that's pretty cool. You know, I'm going to carry that one with me. I think it's also reflective of the culture. It's a bit of a goofy moment, right? And we don't take ourselves too seriously. So I had my birthday, got elected. At that meeting, one of the first things I got to do as a partner was sort of raise my hand and vote in favor of opening in the New York office. My daughter was born 3 weeks later, in the first week of November, and we closed on our apartment in New York. So that all happened in a very compressed time frame and kind of set the stage for the following years. So from then, I moved back to New York. We opened the office. I was one of 7 Fenwick lawyers to help with that effort. And here we are today, 6 years later, we've got 150 lawyers, I think now. So it's just great. And obviously, I can't take more than a sliver of the credit for that. Again, just we've been at the right place at the right time. And it's just been phenomenal.
Could you talk a little bit about Deal Board, which is one of the things that I guess started back when you were in an office and had a whiteboard to help you figure out who was working on your deals?
Yeah. So this has been one of my projects during the pandemic, though the concept was a little bit before. So I have this whiteboard, sort of non-techie thing, or this whiteboard. I write down the deals that I'm on and divide it kind of by phases of term sheet or pre-indication of interest. You're negotiating it. It's between sign and close. It's post-close. Just to kind of help me keep track of things and just to stay organized. But one of the things I would do is write down on each of those sections, like, here are the juniors, here are the associates, here's what the team looks like. And whenever I got a new deal in, I would kind of look up at that board and say, like, okay, so-and-so, Chris is already on 3 deals with me. Asking him to work on a 4th is probably not all that fruitful. And I need to say, we have a free market staffing system at Fenwick. There are lots of different staffing systems that one can have. At Fenwick, it's totally different. It's free market. It's like every partner and every more senior associate, frankly, is responsible for staffing the next person. And it's not built for efficiency, certainly. That is not its purpose. It is, in fact, quite inefficient. Its purpose is as an invisible culture cop, I think, in one sense. And in another, it is consistent with our culture of each lawyer having their own responsibility of shaping their careers. There are pros and cons to all these, which I'll readily admit. So the idea that I had with the deal board was, wouldn't it be nice if I had this board and every other M&A partner had the same board? And then if we all could see each other's boards, that was kind of the concept. Then we started to kind of know all the staffing everywhere and we'd be more efficient about our time. Historically, you know, we all have access to hours and lawyers are subject to incessant tracking of the billable hour and all of that. But, you know, when you think about an M&A practice where it's very lumpy, right? We all think in terms of what deals are you on rather than just fungible hours. And whether you're going to say yes or no to the next deal that comes in is kind of a function of like, okay, not just how many deals am I on, but also what stage are they in? And so that's been the key thing that the deal board has provided is that additional layer of information where I can see not just trailing 1 month and 2 week hours are, but also has this person signed up for a bunch of term sheets or early stage deals that haven't kicked off yet. So their hours might be low, but they're actually not a good candidate because they're about to have a bunch of things that are going to get really busy. Or vice versa, someone might have just gone through a big stretch. Their hours are really high, but that's just because they signed a couple deals. And after you give a breather, right? Like that's the person who might be interested potentially fielding a call. So that was the concept. We built it on Smartsheet and then have layered on more and more tools. It's been really fun to be kind of like a quasi a product guy internally, right? So I view this as a little product project where I have a little team of developers at the firm, not dedicated just to my thing, but they're doing all internal infrastructure stuff. And it's kind of neat to have an idea and say, you know what? This would be more helpful if this was presented in this way. Or now that we have this data, we can actually put out this chart that tells everyone some information that wasn't previously at our fingertips. So that's been a really neat organizational project. And as you might imagine, during the pandemic, when walk the hall staffing is non-existent and we are all not connected as much in the ways that we'd like to be or used to be, having this information available to all of us has been super useful. And I think conducive to having staffing happen in a more equal and fair and appropriate way, you know, it's just been, I think, really, really helpful. And it's been a fun project to work on.
As you've done this, have there been other aspects of your practice that you've looked at and thought might be ripe for this kind of tool, whether that's managing various form documents, keeping track of various deadlines on deals?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think every firm everywhere has its own way of doing knowledge management. And I think where I would personally like to get is to have all the data from all the deals at my fingertips at all times so that whenever I'm in a negotiation or in a conversation with the client, I can just readily say, here's what we do. Here's what the public deal markets say. Here's what we do. Here's some differences. Here's some, you know, explain. Right now, that's a bit anecdotal on the internal side. Tracking that information down, this is an effort. I mean, we tried to do it at S&C. Every firm has their way of doing it, and none of them are perfect. It's hard because it's a very manual process. First, you got to figure out what the right thing is to track. And then you got to make sure that you're tracking that across the whole data set. So you can't just add a new data term, right? You got to kind of look historically and say, okay, this is the data set that we're collecting. And then go through the process of sucking all that data in and then do that going forward. It's a very intensive process. I know there are different products out there and we're experimenting with them. And I think AI is going to be part of the answer here. And we're working on that. But as it relates to the deal board, there was conversation. We did talk about now that we built this tool, is this actually going to be a tool that's useful for that effort as well? And I decided not to do that because I thought that that was going to put too much weight on what I was focused on. The goal of this product was help us with staffing and make sure we're having equitable staffing and appropriate staffing matches. That was my goal and I didn't want to bog it down. But I think technology is definitely going to be improving the way that we deliver our advice. And I'm excited for that. In terms of forms and stuff, yeah, M&A requires obviously lots of different kinds of documents, different shapes and sizes. There are some areas where those documents are less bespoke and where you've got just some fields to enter, you can kind of streamline and speed up the production of these things. But, you know, there's a tension to that too, right? I think that it's a mistake to assume that boilerplate is not important and doesn't require attention. The reason why it's actually boilerplate is because it's been so important that everyone's decided that it's you shouldn't change it, right? There's a potential training loss there. And so we grapple with that, and we need to stay aware that we need to train associates to understand what's there. Why is it there? Why aren't we changing it? Or what is going to be the circumstance in which you should change it? So there are definitely pitfalls to any technological solution that puts forward some efficiencies. You have to think of what you're losing and be conscious of that trade-off.
Right.
And it's fun being in a place like Fenwick too, which is just culturally very open and interested to technological advances to the way we practice law. And we have a number of clients that are in legal tech, and you know, we try out their products and stuff like that. So it's neat. And I think one of the tenets of the firm is some humility, you know, which is to appreciate that we don't think we just have all the right answers and everything we do is done perfectly. I think we're very open-minded to the idea that everything can be done better. And I think that kind of culture and attitude has definitely helped our growth and trajectory during this past expansive period.
And then finally, tell us a little bit about what you do when you're not working or thinking about designing legal technology.
Yeah. I mean, as you probably well know, M&A has been pretty nuts during the pandemic. Other than a blip in March, April, 2020, I think when all of us were like trying to figure out what's going on with the world, it's been a torrid pace. So there isn't a ton of time. I'm looking forward to having a little more time, to be honest. But I have two kids. My son is 4, my daughter is 6. And, you know, they've grown up a lot during the pandemic. And my daughter's in sort of this, at 6, sort of a discovery, it's like a hobby discovery phase, which is just really fun to go through. She'll pick up a thing and be really focused on it and want to get better. So the thing that we've been doing lately, my daughter's classmate had a birthday party, and it's great to be going to birthday parties again. But she had a birthday party. It was an ice skating birthday party at Chelsea Piers. And, you know, she wanted to practice in advance of that so that, you know, she could be good at the birthday party. So, you know, we went and practiced a bunch of times at Bryant Park, and we ended up buying her some ice skates. And, you know, now, and this was right during the Winter Olympics, right? And so she's watching some clips of the Olympics. So she's like all in on the ice skating and the figure skating. And I just think, you know, when you got kids, like you just run with it. And it's just great to have an opportunity to connect with your kid on something. And who knows where it will go. It'll be something else a month from now, but it's been fun. Having grown up in Michigan, I did my stint of junior hockey and stuff. So it's been fun to rekindle some muscle memory, I guess, from a long time ago. And I haven't fallen too much. So that's what we've been up to. We'll see what's next.
And thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, this has been great. It's been fun. Really nice to chat with you, dude. And look forward to the next one.
Awesome. For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.